This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow is International AIDS Day. My guest, Dr. Marcus Conant, was one of the first doctors to treat people with AIDS. Now he runs the largest private practice specializing in AIDS in San Francisco. Dr. Conant is one of the people featured in the four-part documentary A Time of AIDS, which continues on the Discovery Channel December 5th and 12th. There was an interesting and disturbing article about AIDS in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It was written by Jeffrey Schmaltz, a New York Times reporter who made AIDS his beat after he contracted the disease. He died 3 weeks before this magazine article's publication. Schmaltz wrote, "Once AIDS was the hot topic in America, what small advances had been won are now crumbling. The world is moving on, uncaring, frustrated, and bored, leaving by the roadside those of us who are infected and who can't help but wonder whatever happened to AIDS." I wanted to know if Dr. Conant shares Schmaltz's fear that many Americans have lost interest in AIDS.
I do, and I share it for a number of reasons. I think if you look at the United States today, we are complacent that we are doing something about the AIDS epidemic, when in truth, we are losing 50,000 people a year to AIDS, and 50,000 new infections are occurring each year. We've got a steady state epidemic, and when you look around the world, at Southeast Asia and at Sub-Sahara Africa, as you and everyone who reads the paper knows, the epidemic is soaring. So while we don't talk about AIDS anymore in the United States, the AIDS epidemic has certainly not gone away.
Schmaltz made the observation that even the gay movement has pushed AIDS to the sideline. Do you think that's true?
To a degree, yes. I think that, as Jeffrey said in his article, that too many people are tired of hearing of death. They want to hear something positive. The numbing experience of the mid-80s have created a whole new generation of gay men who are anxious to move on beyond AIDS, who are looking for something else in the gay movement beside AIDS. And I think that's why there was so much attention earlier this year to gays in the military. Not that many gay men want to actually serve in the military, but it was a new focus. It was something else the gay community could focus on other than what had occupied them for 12 years.
What impact do you think Clinton has had since he entered the White House?
Well, Clinton is certainly better than Reagan and Bush in terms of being sympathetic to this problem. I share with Jeffrey Schmaltz the concern that the Clinton administration doesn't know what to do about the problem. And I think that too much they are listening to bureaucrats who are conveying to them the sense of frustration that the bureaucracy feels being unable to respond to this epidemic. I mean, let's break that apart. To stop the AIDS epidemic, you need education, you need prevention programs, you need treatment for the people who are sick and dying, and you need an active vaccine program. And of course, the bureaucrats in Washington that are primarily advising Clinton are telling him how frustrated they feel in attacking each of those areas. Education is impossible in this country because we can't discuss sexuality with our children. Prevention is impossible in this country because simple programs like needle exchange are not possible in this country. Treatment was dealt a terrible blow by the Concord data, which was presented in Berlin, showing that not only did AZT and the other antiretrovirals not work as well as we had hoped, they don't appear to work for more than about 2 or 3 years. And so while we thought we were making progress 2 years ago, those hopes were dashed in Berlin. And finally, if you look at the vaccine development programs, they are minuscule. There are less than a half a dozen companies in this country working on vaccines. So I can understand why the bureaucrats, who in fact are slowing down this process, are feeling frustrated. And of course, they're conveying this to the administration. And the message we're getting back from Washington is we're moving as fast as we can. That's not true. We could move much faster if we had people with vision and we had true leaders in there setting the appropriate agendas.
What do you think could be done with the right leadership?
Oh, there's a tremendous amount that could be done, Terry. Let's just take two of the issues that I talked about. Let's take needle exchange programs. It is clear after a decade of studying this disease that the next major group of people in the United States that are going to be infected with AIDS are intravenous drug users and their sexual partners. who don't use drugs. In New York City, there are about 250,000 intravenous drug users, and 60% or more of those have already been infected. You're talking about 180 to 200,000 intravenous drug users who are going to get sick and die of this disease over the next decade. Those people are having sex, and the women and the men they're having sex with are going to contract this disease and, in fact, pass the disease on to their unborn children. In San Francisco, where I am, we have about 12,000 intravenous drug users, and only between 12 and 15%, not 60 to 70%, of our intravenous drug users have been infected. We could substantially stop the further transmission of this disease by distributing clean needles. And yet recently, the governor of the state of California said that even though he knew people would die of AIDS if clean needles were not distributed, he felt that by distributing needles, it would send a message that this government condones intravenous drug use. Now, no one condones intravenous drug use. We need a program to stop intravenous drug use. But is it a capital crime? Should we say that people who use drugs deserve to die? And that's what's happening in this country. So we could tomorrow have a national, well-controlled needle exchange program where we could start working with addicts to make them understand that while we don't approve of what they're doing, they could use clean needles and not transmit the disease. If you look at vaccine development, this country should, initiate an international vaccine development program utilizing traditional vaccine methods, which means whole killed virus and inactivated virus for vaccines, as well as some of the elegant subunit vaccines that are being looked at by companies such as Chiron and Genentech. In other words, we need a multidisciplinary program looking at all of the different vaccine strategies, testing them in areas where the disease is spreading rapidly. If you look at street prostitutes in India, only 5 or 6% are currently infected. Over the next decade, that will rise to 60%. And we have good evidence for that from Thailand. Those individuals would be ideal candidates for new vaccine trials to find ways of reducing the transmission of this disease. This country should take a leadership position in those types of initiatives.
Do you think that in your position as heading up a large private practice dealing with AIDS, that you are seeing things that others might not be in a position to see in terms of the progress, you know, the progression of the illness?
We're seeing some hopeful signs, Terry, in terms of progression of illness. When I started doing this 12 years ago, the average time between a diagnosis of AIDS, using the old definition, and death was about 6 months. And now in our clinic, that's more than 40 months. It's patients are living seven times longer than they did a decade ago.
Why are they living longer?
I think there are five reasons. And briefly stated, the first is natural selection. Some people get sick and die of this disease sooner than others, and we can do very little about that. That has to do with your genetics. And so we have selected for people who are survivors, who are living longer. But even more important, I think that the prophylactic treatment against the diseases that used to kill patients, prophylaxing against pneumocystis, prophylaxing against cryptococcal meningitis, prophylaxing and preventing with drugs a Mycobacterium avium complex, those kinds of approaches are substantially prolonging the lives of our patients. Then I think aggressive patient involvement, patients going and finding doctors who are aggressive, who will treat their disease aggressively, patients who are not content with the doctor saying, well, there's not much we can do, why don't you come back in 3 months? Those patients are living longer. I think physicians are becoming more aggressive. 10 years ago, I was told repeatedly, oh, there's no need to treat this patient with nutrients given by vein because, quote, he's going to die anyway. Nowadays, we know that if you're aggressive, if you manage patients aggressively, if you manage the infections they present with, these patients live longer. And the fifth element is antiretroviral therapy, AZT, DDC, DDI, alone or in combination. And you take all five of these things and put them together, and we see patients living longer. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that we're more than a decade into an epidemic of an infectious disease caused by a virus, and we still don't understand how the virus makes us sick, and we don't have in the pipeline effective drugs that we think are going to substantially block the progression of that virus in the short run.
Are the demographics of the patients that you're seeing changing as the demographics of the epidemic changes?
We're seeing
the statistics are that, you know, the largest new percentage of people getting infected are women and minorities, intravenous drug users.
Right, and you're absolutely right. The figures show that now between 12% and 15% of all of the new cases are amongst women, and that's absolutely terrifying, because as these women become infected, they will, as a matter of course, infect their unborn children. We're not seeing that in our practice here in San Francisco because of a variety of factors, including entitlement. Ours is a private practice where we see patients who have insurance that pays for their medical care. The places where we are seeing increases in infected women and children, of course, are substantially in the inner cities, places like Baltimore and Brooklyn and the Bronx. And in those clinics, they are seeing substantial rises in the numbers of women and children infected with HIV. As everyone predicted back in the early 1980s, I think that your audience must remember that there were many of us, Matilda Krim and me and many, many others, telling Congress back in 1983 exactly what we were going to see. And we had people like Jesse Helms on the floor of the United States Senate saying, that's not true. If homosexuals will just quit having sex, this disease will stop. Now, that was not true. It has not been true. And we have been badly served by that type of advice, because that type of advice has kept us from bringing to the American people the kinds of information that was necessary to stop a fatal epidemic.
My guest is Dr. Marcus Conant, one of the most experienced AIDS doctors in the country. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Marcus Conant, and he's been treating people with AIDS since the very start of the epidemic. He's considered to have what is perhaps the largest private practice dealing with AIDS. What is it like for you in trying to keep up the hopes of your patients when on a kind of political level, on a scientific research level, you're in fact very pessimistic about hope for the near future?
Well, I sound pessimistic, but we continue to look for new initiatives to move some of these agendas along. I think that if we just give up, if we do what has happened to many, where we just throw up our hands and say, what can we do, then the future is indeed bleak. If we realize that it is our responsibility to take this epidemic into our own hands and to find solutions for these problems, then I think that we can be hopeful. If we continue to believe that we're going to see answers from the U.S. government, I think that we are going to face failure. And what we need to do, Terry, is to look at, okay, that's not working. What can we do that will work? And let me give you a brief example. For women's reproductive health, many of the pharmaceutical companies of America got out of that business in the early 1970s because of lawsuits and pressure from the religious right against drugs such as birth control pills. A private, not-for-profit foundation called the Population Council was set up, and most of the research on women's reproductive health in the United States over the last decade, two decades, have been done by that organization. And indeed, Norplant was brought to market by research that was coordinated and funded through the Population Council. So what you have is a private, not-for-profit foundation doing what the pharmaceutical industry and the federal government could not or would not fund and implement. Perhaps with AIDS we need something like that. Perhaps we need to say the government's failing us, the pharmaceutical industries are too focused on patents that run for 17 years and the bottom line, the vaccine companies won't develop vaccines because they don't see a market in the United States. Perhaps we need to look at private, not-for-profit foundations, get funding from major funders around the world, such as the World Bank, and look at developing what the world needs, which is an effective vaccine and hopefully more beneficial treatments.
Dr. Conant, what has it been like for you to treat people with AIDS for so long? You must have seen so many of your patients die. It's, I think, very difficult for a doctor to keep with an epidemic like this.
Terry, a number of things keep you going, and while there have been days where I've said, yes, I'm going to quit this and move to New York, and while there have been days when you don't want to do it anymore, and I would be foolish to suggest those don't occur and continue to occur, overall, given 12 years of working with something which is scientifically as exciting as the AIDS epidemic, this has been a true privilege. Very few physicians are ever afforded the opportunity of being at the center of a major medical catastrophe at a point in their career where they had the resources to really deal with that medical emergency. I think one of the reasons that you can avoid burnout, which is suggested by your question, is, you know, how do you do this day after day and watch your friends die, is that you stay focused in your day-to-day practice on what you can do. If you believe for a moment that you can prolong someone's life unreasonably, if you believe that you can conquer the disease, if you believe that you will not ultimately lose, then of course when the patient dies, you're devastated. If you focus on what you can do, which is I can keep this man working till the end, I can keep him comfortable, I can keep him happy, and when he dies, whereas everyone else in society has fled and abandoned him, we have not. We have been there for him through this disease up to the end, then you can feel very positive about the role you played in your friend and patient's life.
Dr. Conant, you're a dermatologist. How did you first start working with people with AIDS?
Because the first disease that we saw, Terry, was Kaposi's sarcoma, which was this malignancy of the skin, which in those days was affecting more than 50% of all the AIDS patients in San Francisco. Remember that the reason that skin disease has been around a long time and skin doctors have been around a long time is that the first organ of the body that we see is our skin. And so dermatology began as a specialty dealing with syphilis back shortly after the time of Columbus. Dermatologists have dealt with diseases like leprosy through history, and it was not surprising that when a disease that manifested itself as a cutaneous, a skin malignancy, Kaposi sarcoma, came along, that many dermatologists were involved. I'm not the only dermatologist. Al Friedman Keene in New York is another dermatologist, and it was actually Al who saw the first cases of Kaposi sarcoma at New York University in 1981.
When did you first realize that something was terribly wrong?
In April of 1981. And you can date it fairly easily because, Terry, there's nothing mysterious about this disease. I mean, this is a sexually transmitted bloodborne disease. I had worked in the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic back in the 1960s as a volunteer when I was in residency. And in those days, we began to see an epidemic of genital herpes. Only about 5% of sexually active young heterosexual and homosexual kids, mostly heterosexual kids, were coming down with genital herpes. But during that period of time, the late 60s and early 70s, when kids started using, experimenting with sex and using sex almost for entertainment, then we saw an epidemic of genital herpes. And now in San Francisco, between 40 and 60% of sexually active young adults are infected with genital herpes. And so over a 20-year period, we went from 5% to 60%. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist in 1981 to find an epidemic of a new disease spreading rapidly amongst gay men in the Castro to realize that the same thing that happened with herpes was going to happen with this disease. Men were having sex with men, they were having multiple sexual partners, and this disease appeared to be sexually transmitted. Those are the elements for a catastrophe.
You know, it strikes me you were probably prepared for a practice of acne and rashes and certain kinds of cancers, but maybe primarily acnes and rashes and just more typical dermatological problems, certainly not a terminal illness like AIDS. Was it hard for you to adjust to what your job was becoming?
It was, but again, take it in terms of the history. In the first 3 to 5 years of the epidemic, Terry, from the time we started seeing these first patients in 81, until, say, Rock Hudson's death and the time the antibody test became available, and that was in 1985. So the first 4 years of the epidemic, I and I think many others working in the field, probably most, believed that we were dealing with something and all we had to do was to bring the spotlights of science on it, we would understand it, and it would stop and go away. And we would go back to our laboratories or to taking care of acne and psoriasis or whatever, that we would go back to business as usual. We thought this was going to be something like Legionnaire's disease or toxic shock syndrome, or the Tylenol poisonings, all of which occurred around the same time, which if we could just get smart enough, fast enough, we would conquer it and it would go away. And so there was time to adjust to the idea that, yes, we're losing lots of people. But that was in the context of, but this is temporary. Soon our efforts are going to pay off. Beginning about 1985, we then began to realize that this is here for the long haul, that there will be AIDS to the year 2000. There will be AIDS the rest of my professional career. Everyone going into medicine today will wet his or her teeth on patients with AIDS. That's what they will see in medical school, and they will still be seeing those patients when they complete their careers 40 years later.
In your practice, you're tracking, I believe, about 2,000 patients now?
Well, about 3,000, yes.
Oh. Well, are there specific things that you're looking for in your tracking of them? And obviously you're treating them, but you're probably, you know, studying them as well to see what you can learn about the epidemic.
We have tried to answer the question, why are some patients living longer than others? Why do some people seem to handle this disease so well and others do not? Over the years, we have looked for various cofactors, things like cytomegalovirus infections or herpes infections that seem to make the disease spread more rapidly. And we have some patients, perhaps 15% of all the patients we've seen, who've shown no progression at all. I have patients in my practice, Terry, who I know were infected because we have blood samples stored. We know they were infected in 1978. And they still have essentially normal numbers of helper T cells. Now, why is that? Because if we could answer that question and take the patients who are not doing well and modify their immune systems in a similar way, then clearly that would be far more effective than any drug we have. So yes, we've done studies. That's the good news. The bad news is we have not found any common denominator that we can point to say this is the element that we need to focus on.
Dr. Conant, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Dr. Marcus Conant treats people with AIDS in San Francisco. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.